Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday. It's January 7th. Before we get to the weather real quickly, traffic just heard is stopped on Interstate I-80 eastbound between Jeremy Ranch and the 224 exit. Sounds like we got a lot of people coming up to enjoy the snow and the blue skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. I'm going to go ahead and see if I can pull it up as well. We have this new product that we're using. It's fantastic. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and take a look at our current conditions. We're seeing our very low current as far as our current temperature at 5 degrees, even though we were having some kind of discrepancies with your populating those current temps in Park City. It was very interesting this morning, so definitely have to keep an eye on that. Now, humidity is right now at 85%, and the winds are calm. Dew points at 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So there's a little bit of moisture out there, not too much. Ridge of high pressure is developing. So temperatures for today in the low to mid 30s. And then we have overnight lows in the teens, developing cloud by later tonight into Friday. And then we're going to track a weak trough that's going to dig on in and really just bring us some isolated showers at most late Friday into Saturday morning, and then clear by the early hours on Saturday. The latest we'll see any flurries will be 10, 11 a.m. And then we're going to see a good amount of sunshine, partly cloudy skies. The high for your Friday, 34 degrees. Overnight lows in the upper teens for Friday into Saturday. And then cooler for this weekend, or chillier for this weekend, because there is a frontal boundary associated with that trough. The high expected on Saturday, 25 degrees. And then on Sunday, we're going to see 26 degrees as your expected high. Overnight lows in the low teens. 12, 13, 14 degrees. It really is going to be a very cold stretch ahead for this weekend. But the great news is by Monday, we'll see more sunshine starting to develop. And it looks like we will see temperatures climbing right around the freezing mark for Park City. And then we're going to see overnight lows in the upper teens with a mix of sun and clouds by Tuesday. We're going to go ahead and increase cloud coverage. I don't see any precip anytime soon, as far as anything that could be inclement weather by next Monday or Tuesday. Beyond that, of course, we'll be tracking very closely for you. And I'm looking at any accidents right now on our traffic flow. It's one of the newer products we have. I don't see anything populating at this point. So it very well could be just people trying to get up to Park City. Why not? It's gorgeous right now. I showed that shot so many times. It's absolutely stunning on Main Street. But as I look at our flat traffic flow right now in real time, there is nothing. It seems that traffic is flowing okay. So that could be something that's just right, just probably an issue that's local, and maybe people, again, just trying to get into town to enjoy the weekend.
Okay. Erica, thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
And on the phone with us, let's hang on to just a sec here. Calm. Jumping the gun there on the phone with us now from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. I got Drew. Good morning, Drew.
Morning, Leslie. Not really sure what to say. It's just that our luck is going to run out soon. Even sort of from the vantage of many of the ski resorts on the Park City Ridgeline, Leslie, just it seemed that the unintentionally triggered avalanches and close calls continued without pause or much beyond that for most of the day. Even solo skiers getting caught and carried in steep avalanche terrain, and if not but for the grace of God, I should say, it's really something. And conditions are dangerous. I'm really surprised we didn't have any fatalities or more significant avalanche accidents yesterday. We are dawning anew, and conditions remain just as dangerous as they were yesterday, and we're avoiding people. We're telling people to avoid steep terrain in the backcountry and kind of wait for things to settle down right now. So thanks for helping us spread the word, Leslie. Conditions are dangerous. We just hope to avoid any tragedy or accidents today.
Yeah, tell me a little bit of there. I saw this great photo by Alex Hepworth on your website here off of Square Top. That's here locally.
It is. Yeah, I mean, we have world-class powder, and honestly, it's some of the best skiing and riding of the year. And, right from the ski areas, you can very easily well, from the canyon ski area, you know, I think the other resorts have closed boundaries, but you can very easily access the Park City Ridgeline, you know, there and Square Top and Red Rock Chutes and the Monitors and on and on and on, and just sort of riding the chairs, you can get up there and very easily access this very steep, dangerous terrain. And Square Top is a known killer. I can't remember, Leslie, what year, maybe 2004, when an out-of-state couple had put their children in daycare.
Yeah, they were actually locals, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and went out of bounds on the Square Top, and at the end of the day, people were like, well, we have these children, and their parents haven't picked them up yet, and they were both killed in that avalanche off Square Top.
Yeah, I'm looking at this photo though, and you see this some turns coming into it, where it cracks there, and it's like, but nothing's skiing out, and you know, nice thing of cliffs right there too. I mean, we know this person's okay.
I'm sure that I would be made aware of a catch and carry or any sort of accident or anything of that nature.
Yeah.
By now.
Yeah, you just can't see where this person may have skied out, though. That's what's so weird.
Yeah, for sure. There are reports of a triple inbound fatality in Idaho at a resort. So some details coming in at this point. I'm just starting to look into that a little bit, but it's certainly dangerous across the West, and there have been lots of warnings and high danger that sort of can persist through now and this week, you know.
Okay. Be careful if you're headed out. Drew,
yep.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Well, when the COVID-19 pandemic struck last spring, it seemed as if everything in Summit County was closed down or severely restricted. That was not the case for two of the county's natural attractions, the Echo and Rockport Reservoirs. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, the Summit County Council yesterday heard a review of the two state parks.
The council members heard from Eric Bradshaw, the manager for the Echo and Rockport Reservoir Complex, who said he had never seen crowds like last summer. He said the pandemic led to some cancellations. The Dam Jam music event at Rockport was called off for the first time in 26 years. After the first heavy lockdown, he said they could only admit county residents. However, they started seeing traffic from locals who were turned away from the Jordanelle in Wasatch County, but could go to Echo and Rockport.
And then we opened it up to everybody, and visitation skyrocketed. We saw at Rockport, we saw a 79% increase in visitation. Echo saw a similar increase. Pretty much every weekend we were full and only letting so many people in, so many people out. Even though we were really full, people were able to maintain social distancing because we have a lot of shoreline. They spread out, both were, you know, it was really good summer for us, really busy. Even with all those extra contacts, none of our staff even contracted COVID, which was good.
An upgrade to the Echo campground was finished in mid-June and was constantly full through the summer.
We got lots of positive comments. A lot of people liked the facilities that we have there. Bigger campsites to accommodate larger motorhomes. It was becoming the norm in motorhomes, just bigger, larger, more roomy.
State Parks took over the management of both reservoirs in 2018. Bradshaw said the response from the locals around Colville and Hennifer has been good.
Most of the locals really, really like what we've done and what we're planning on doing, where the previous management seemed kind of more closed circle, like inner group almost, where now it seems more like it's more open to the public, more accessible to everybody.
He added that the two reservoirs froze over during the holidays. He said that Rockport has 6 inches of ice and Echo has 10 to 11 inches. He said in both areas, tent cities for ice fishing are springing up. Bradshaw said that this spring they will begin a construction upgrade at Echo. They will extend a boat ramp, thereby extending the boating season. We'll add lodging units and improve the day use area. The project should be done in 10 months to a year. He said for a later phase, they plan to develop a campground at the south end of Echo near the junction of Chalk Creek and the Weber River. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, the Summit County Council met for its first regular meeting of the new year yesterday. On the phone with a recap, I have Council Member Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug, and Happy New Year to you.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
The council spent some time setting committee assignments. I believe you are one of the three council members on the new Snyderville Transit District Board. Who are the other two?
I believe it's Chris and Roger, I believe. Yes.
Okay. The health board will continue to be an important group because of COVID, of course. Who's taking over Kim Carson's seat on that?
Roger is going to assume that.
Okay. And then we have a couple of council members watching the state legislature. Or are we going to have more people involved to avoid another kind of backdoor deal like the hideout annexation?
Well, I don't know that we have the capability of actually avoiding something like hideout from happening again. Those forces are always there. I think the general consensus was that this may involve various council members in various topics, and that we just need to be flexible, and we need to make sure that we provide the right people at the right time.
So any other significant assignments for you?
I'm just happy at this point to be over with my role as chair.
What about our new council member, Melina Stevens? What's she taking on, do you know?
I didn't pull up the assignments right okay. In front of me. We've given her, but just in general, we've given her some roles that will have her interact with the legislature and with UAC, with the League of Counties, Association of Counties, excuse me.
Okay.
And
putting another woman back in that role, huh?
What's that?
Putting another woman back in that role, huh?
Well, I think our general interest in Melina's future is that, and I think somebody actually mentioned this last night, with any luck at all, she's going to outlive the rest of us. So we're concerned about the fact that that there be an orderly succession of informed people going forward, and Melina is one of those people.
And I say that sort of tongue-in-cheek, just given the issues that Kim Carson had as a female there on that UAC assignment.
Well, of course, and Melina's perfectly capable of understanding and managing those issues.
All right. We just filed the report on the busy year that both Echo and Rockport reservoirs have had. What's your reaction?
I think that we were, in some respects, we were, pleasantly surprised because our businesses on the east side did a decent job during the summer, but it also is a wake-up call to us that our facilities can be overrun and our ability to manage those facilities can evaporate in a heartbeat.
All right. The recommendations for the RAP tax recreation projects, you just heard the presentation. You're scheduled to make a decision next week, is my understanding. $950,000. Oh, that's a boatload of money. In the recommendations, most of the applicants either got the entire sum they asked for or were recommended for nothing, the exception being the Utah Olympic Park. Can you explain why that is?
Well, it's what we're seeing is the consensus of the RAP tax committee. And they have a variety of criteria that they go through in order to prioritize those items. And while we certainly did not hear an exhaustive explanation, I think we heard enough last night on those individual items to understand why they made the decision that they did. For example, one of them was for an upgraded lighting plan in a particular facility. But it already had LED lights. The facility was a functional facility. This was essentially you know, an improvement, but it wasn't going to make more recreation immediately available, et cetera. So that an upgrade of an existing functional facility would play a secondary role, perhaps, to a repair of an existing facility that otherwise wasn't functioning. I don't think they were any more complicated than that, generally. Other than the fairground planning request was denied simply because the appearance of it was that it was just a little bit too speculative. It didn't result in what they thought was a concrete plan, and I think that's appropriate.
And there were, again, a couple applications. You had reservations for the ice arena and for pit toilets near Around Valley Trailhead. why don't these kind of pass the test for you?
Well, they're two separate things. One is that, they both stem from the same thing. They both stem from not properly capitalizing facilities to begin with. Mm. And the, you know, we all want things to happen, and we all want them to happen now. And, you know, an example of that might be the ice arena, although it only took, I think, about 30 years. But then we end up in a budget crunch, and then we end up making bad decisions. And in the case of the ice arena, it's my understanding that the HVAC system, the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system, was designed for the building to operate seasonally. That, I think, represented a serious error in judgment on somebody's part. You just should not build a $20 million plus facility, just picking that number out of the air, with the understanding that, well, we're just going to get it up and limping along. There shouldn't have been a person in the county who didn't understand that that was going to be a year-round demand.
Yeah, and then with regard to the pit toilets, I mean, that sounds like a health and safety issue. It sounds like we got to do something.
We have existing toilets there that are serviced like any portable toilet is. So it's not a health issue so much as it is the purpose of it was to lower the actual O&M, operation and maintenance costs of the facility. My problem with that is simply, again, when you spend monies, when you spend the public monies, do it prudently, but also do it with a view of what the public wants. And we know from decades of studies of users of primitive facilities, of trails and campgrounds, et cetera, that pit toilets are just not considered acceptable in these days. And there's other technology, and I don't mean connecting to sewer, that should be employed in those sort of situations if we are the environmentally sensitive county that we purport to be, and certainly a long-term solution.
I guess I don't understand that. If we don't put it connected to the sewer, then don't we have pit toilets?
No. There are composting toilets out there. They've been out there. Composting toilets have been around probably for 50 plus years. And the most common one, which is referred to both generically and specifically as Clivus Multrum, was patented in the 60s. So this is not new.
So they just didn't ask for the right kind of toilet, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, exactly. And again, you know, toilet facilities, they need to be serviced, and they need to be attractive in the sense that you feel comfortable going into them, and pit toilets just aren't that.
Yeah. Let's see. The schedule for the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission to have work sessions and develop recommendations in 6 months, is that too aggressive of a schedule?
Well, it's a very aggressive schedule, but we've said to the Planning Commission, look, this is an iterative process, so you don't have to deliver to us a finalized bit of text that is essentially ready for publication. What we need to understand is, what the ideas and the concepts are, and what you feel changes should be accommodated in our plan going forward. But we don't need you to do every line of punctuation. So hopefully that will put us on a track where we do get some incremental information, we're able to get some back and forth going with the Planning Commission, and hopefully take some of the pain out of the process, value their time and our time both a little bit more, and staff time, of course, get it done.
The proposed schedule doesn't have public hearings until June. Should the Planning Commission get some public input before we get so far along?
Well, we talked about this. This is an update of the existing general plan. And while certainly we didn't get any work done on that during the last year, which was, I think, 4 years after the publication of the plan, we will in the future, and we're supposed to revisit those plans every year annually. But, of course, the last plan probably took about 4 or 5 years to develop, so we are not obviously going to circle back and do the same amount of public input. What we're going to do is explain to the public that we're looking at some particular areas of interest, and we would like their specific input on that, and I think that the Planning Commission will handle that in their work sessions or public hearings.
Yeah. Wanted to ask, were all of the council members distracted yesterday, kind of going through the routine actions to start the council while watching all the sound and fury disrupting the process in our nation's capital, or were you inside of a bubble of ignorance and didn't even know about it?
I found out about it shortly before going on to the call. I certainly was distracted. Certainly I don't know about the other members to what extent they were, but yes.
Yeah. What were you thinking?
That we have a president who is mentally incompetent and is at a peril, and we are at his peril. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, of course, another death was reported yesterday in Summit County due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Any thoughts about that?
Well, the COVID situation, of course, is very bad throughout the states in general, United States in general. Utah is not in good shape. We hit a record the other day statewide. We are doing slightly better in Summit County, but not a lot. And that, of course, represents the fact that as we get into our winter season, there are a lot more people moving around spreading the virus in ways that we weren't really dealing with in the fall. So yes, COVID is still an extreme threat. It's going to take us a long time to get everybody vaccinated, especially since we have limited supply of vaccine. And even when we're told what vaccine we're going to get, we don't always get what we're promised.
Okay. Anything else, Doug?
I think that's it, Leslie.
All right.
I hope that we're looking forward to a much better year to come. Thank you.
That's Summit County Council Member Doug Clyde. KPCW News Time, 8:31. Well, Park City residents who have been in the area long enough might remember a zebra living in the backyard of a home off of Highway 40. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has more on where that zebra is now.
She likes to eat all the goodies. Dave Belcher and his wife bought Ace the Zebra shortly after they built their Park City home in 2001. While they've had other animals like goats, deer, sheep, bison, and a donkey, Belcher says a zebra is the most out of place in a state like Utah.
Yeah, they in snow up their belly sometimes, and you're going, really?
Few things have stayed the same in the past two decades since the Belchers moved to Park City. Unfortunately, Ace died in 2012. However, the family quickly bought another zebra, who Belcher says has a better temperament.
They're pretty mean. They love to kick and bite. We had one zebra, and it got sick, and we lost it, so we got another one, and the new one we have is Zippy. And you can put a lead rope on her and a halter and walk her, but the minute she hears a noise, they're like on hyperventilating. They hear one little noise, they just go nuts. They just take off and start running.
The family also moved about 6 miles east of downtown Heber, which has presented its own set of challenges.
When we moved, we fenced an area and then put a barn for the animals, and we didn't realize it, but after we'd been there about 8 months, I didn't realize there's mountain lions over there, and they got in and killed some of our small animals, our two little goats, our two little sheep, and our little deer.
The Belchers' larger animals, like the bison, donkey, and zebra, survived the attacks. Belcher says the animals now sleep in the barn, and he's since further fenced in and gated the area to keep out predators. Belcher bought his zebra from a breeder in southern Utah, and all he needed was a $40 permit to keep her in his backyard. The breeder's website is zebrasrus.com, which is in fact a real website.
Look it up. You'll love it. They have some nice pictures. They have a herd of zebras where they raise zebras and sell them.
And for anyone who's looking to get their own zebra, Belcher says that owning one doesn't require any more work than a horse or a cow.
You have to feed it a couple times a day. You have to have water, good water source, especially in the winter, so they keep hydrated. And then hay, we give them grass hay, not alfalfa.
Belcher says there likely are other people in Utah with the exotic pet, but he's pretty sure Zippy is the only zebra in the area. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
8:34 now. Good morning. Well, the woman who has guided Summit County's green initiatives for the last several years is retiring. Lisa Yoder joins me now in the studio, along with her replacement, who has already been hired, Emily Quinton. Good morning, all.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning.
And Lisa, let's start with you. You started with the county when?
In 2013.
Okay. Well, talk about why you're retiring then. Just got started.
2013, yeah, 8 years ago. Well, it's just time. Personally, some personal interests and the request of my partner so that we can have some time together while we both have good health, and we know that. Things can change in an instant, as everybody knows.
Okay. Talk to us a little bit about what you think some of your biggest accomplishments were over the last 8 years.
Primarily that we've partnered with the utility and other municipalities and businesses to develop renewable energy at operational scale for six partners. And then in the process of developing that availability of renewable energy for entire communities throughout Utah.
So big goals by the county to have all county operations powered by renewable energy. As soon as next year, is that going to happen?
By 2023, we'll be purchasing that power in a power purchase agreement with those other entities. Yes, so it is happening way ahead of schedule. We're scheduled to do that by 2030. So we're about 7 years ahead of the target.
Yeah, I thought the 2030 goal was to have the entire county, not just county operations.
There's two goals.
Mm-hmm.
So one is for county operations, and the other is to make it available countywide by 2030.
Okay, is that going to happen?
That's the HB 411 Community Renewable Energy Act that was passed last year. So yes, we anticipate that to happen. There are multiple steps required to achieve that, and we're working through those steps with those other 20 communities right now.
All right. So anything in particular that frustrated you?
well, sustainability is complex. It's scientific, it's technical, it's social. It requires lots of partners. So, and it's always new technology. We're usually pushing the envelope. So it's a matter of getting all parties on board to make these things happen, to invest in technologies that are relatively new but proven. So it takes some doing to get all parties engaged and pushing in the same direction, or at least not resisting. So there's been times where it's been frustrating, but that's part of the that's been part of the overall joy of it all is working through those complications. Yeah. It's never been dull, I'll say that.
Well, you know, of course, we've got Park City, Summit County, Salt Lake City kind of on board, some of the resorts. What about the rest of the state, though? I mean, are they catching on to the...
Well, we were totally surprised with HB 411. It required communities to pass a resolution to also become 100% net renewable by 2030. And to my surprise, we had 23 communities, that's cities and counties throughout the state, to adopt resolutions in line with that same goal. So it's changing. And the utility partnered with us to pass that legislation. So that tells you the whole landscape is changing in Utah.
Yeah. You're on staff until, what, just the end of the month?
January 31st, correct.
And that's to kind of help?
To transition Emily Quinton. We did a national search for my replacement, and we were thrilled to find Emily. She comes to us from Portland with excellent experience, knowledge. She's scientific-minded, and we feel like a great fit for the county.
Okay, so Emily, introduce us to yourself. I mean, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you've been doing.
Yeah, sure, thank you. So my name is Emily Quinton. I'm coming to Summit County from the Sustainability Office at Portland State University. My background is in sustainability and environmental work, largely in the higher ed and K-12 education sectors. At the university, I was involved in a variety of different programs. I mean, I think it's pretty typical for anybody in a sustainability role to wear a lot of hats, but I'm really thrilled. I was leading the university's efforts to implement a renewable energy strategy, so there's a lot of overlap with the learning and effort to work with utility partners, understand state utility regulation, and understand what our choices are for energy that I think will translate really well to continuing the incredible work that Lisa's been doing in the county.
Yeah. So any particular marching orders from the county council? You haven't even gone that been before them, I'm guessing. Maybe they introduced you yesterday.
I haven't had a chance to meet with the council yet, but certainly Lisa is helping me to understand the goals that the county updated in 2019. So I'm, getting used to understanding what the greenhouse gas reduction goals targets are, renewable energy targets, transportation and fleet transition targets, and I look forward to working with the council to really understand what their hopes and desires are. I'm thrilled to be coming into a community where the council really does have a strong vision and that there's so many opportunities to work with partners throughout the county, both staff at the county, but then community members.
Okay, so you started this week, but you're still got kind of a foot in each state?
Yeah. I'll be working remotely a little bit from Oregon as I make the full move out here to the area. And I'm imagine it'll be a lot of Zoom meetings, getting to know folks, and actually getting right to start with the annual greenhouse gas emissions inventory. And I'm, very, very thankful to have Lisa to help show me the ropes.
Yeah. Did you find a place to live?
Not yet. I'm working on it.
Good luck.
Thank you.
I know it's tough. And then Lisa, you just plan to stay around, but do some traveling and other fun things?
Right. I plan to do a lot of outdoor recreation. That's my favorite thing. And just kind of relax into free time and see what comes next. I don't have any particular ambitions, but a lot of ambitions, so, and a lot of energy. So we'll see where I end up directing that. I'll be around. I've thoroughly enjoyed the position and the council and the partners that I've worked with over these many years. And I'm just honored to have served the residents of Summit County.
All right. Well, Lisa, thanks, and thanks for your good work, and look forward to working with you, Emily.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the position.
Thanks a lot. Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now is 8:42. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Heber City Council met yet again to discuss the North Village Overlay Zone, or NVOZ, which, if ultimately approved, would nearly double the size of Heber City. Nearly 200 people zoomed in for Tuesday's meeting. Comments came from virtual participants, emails, and even some in-person attendees. The purpose of taking public comment was to hear continued concerns about the city's process to make changes to the existing zoning code. The council has not approved the overlay zone. Tuesday's meeting was the fourth opportunity for public input. Heber City Planner Tony Kohler said the growth anticipated north of town is inevitable. The original density approvals were granted by Wasatch County some 20 years ago.
North of town from Heber to Park City, there are developments that total 13,000 ERUs. That is an equivalent residential unit. If most of those are built as a residence and some of those turn as commercial enterprises, you are looking at a population that could reach 30,000 to 35,000.
There were multiple comments from attendees asking the council to consider transportation, traffic, and trail connections carefully. John Kenworthy owns the River's Edge Resort below the Jordanell Dam.
And I've been very impressed in the city process and the public comment. I want to focus on trails and regional transportation in the future. I want to make sure that there are plans for this within this area that's being zoned right now.
Many participants concerned with traffic. Wasatch County Planning Commission member Scott Brubaker expressed what he said are his personal opinions on the NVOZ.
There's a little more study that needs to be done. And as a civil engineer, I know you can at least get some guidelines from traffic engineers as to what this is going to do. And it's a big enough project that we could have give them three or four scenarios and have them work that up. I think traffic is the main issue.
Another unidentified resident said the traffic problems at Kimball Junction in Park City should be a cautionary tale for Heber as the NVOZ waits for approval from the council. Several people asked the council to address infrastructure and road issues, such as building a bypass before development gets underway.
My biggest concern is around traffic. And I've seen some comments about we don't want another Kimball Junction. Nobody really thought about the impact, the cumulative impact of all the development. Kimball desperately needs a bypass, which is almost impossible to do because they waited so late to do it.
Dan Simmons said the environmental impacts of the North Village development and zone changes should be the top priority.
I too agree that having environment last is a mistake. You want environment near the top of the list. I also believe that the city's assessment that traffic won't change is not accurate. I can't see that possibly being the case since the developer's own studies say that traffic will change.
Megan Lawrence, who is new to Heber, said she's concerned that affordable high-density housing will bring more crime to the Heber Valley.
So we just moved up here in May, actually, from West Jordan. My issue is all the talk of high-density housing. I lived in West Jordan for 10 years, and there was tons of high-density housing. I live right in areas with it. Those areas started seeing a lot of crime and a lot of issues just because they were affordable. That's just mainly the comment I want to make is, what will that do to our quality of life in Heber, allowing for so much high-density housing?
Public input lasted for almost 3 hours with a response session from the council that followed. A link to all of that public input can be found on our website, kpcw.org. Well, the NEE Casey Foundation issued a Kids and Families COVID-19 Pandemic Pain Report late last year and issued an urgent message that there is a pressing need to respond to the hardship the pandemic has caused to so many. On the phone to talk about strategies outlined in the report to meet the needs that were identified in the report is Terry Haven, the Deputy Director with Voices for Utah Children. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it appears that Utah is faring better than many other states on various indicators. What were the most concerning findings from the report to you about Utah?
I think for me, one of the biggest problems that I saw was in terms of mental health. During the pulse survey, they found out that 20% of adults with children in the household felt that they were down, depressed, hopeless, and that's very comparable to the United States, which was at 21%. So that one indicator is very much on par with what the United States is feeling. And it's a problem because mental health is a problem in our state in terms of coverage and service providing. So that was a big concern. And it's also, I think, I mean, we did do better than the nation on the areas that they were looking at, which were food security, housing stability, and affordable health care, aside from mental health. But I think there's a danger in comparing us to everybody else, because we tend to say, oh, we're so much better than the nation, then we forget that, but we do still have problems. So,
yeah. So, I mean, what did you find in the survey then for access to health care and to these mental health services?
Well, 9% of the people that were surveyed said that they did not have health insurance, which is a problem. And we know that in Utah, in terms of child health insurance, we're the worst in the nation. So that was an issue. Food security, they found that 7% of adults in Utah families who had children said they sometimes or often did not have enough to eat. And in terms of housing stability, 12% had slight or no confidence that they would make the next rent or mortgage payment on time. So obviously there's some families who are struggling, and we need to kind of look at what's going on and what can we do.
So, yeah, that's my next question. What do we do about it?
What do we do? The Casey Foundation in the report gave a lot of different kinds of recommendations in terms of prioritizing the physical and mental health of children and helping families with children achieve, you know, financial stability and bolstering their well-being. I think, I mean, the recommendations are good, and I think if people go onto the report and read them, I think they would be great. But I think it's more important to say what would work here in Utah, right? I mean, what's the best for what's happening in Utah? And for us at Voices for Utah Children, we just introduced a new campaign called Invest in Utah Kids. And with the new governor coming on and the legislature starting to happen, we just thought it was a good time to, you know, look at our various public policy areas that have the greatest impact on kids. Things like education, healthcare, juvenile justice, economics, and find out what are the recommendations we would make for our state and what is happening. We have a great report on our website that looks at all of that stuff, but we know that it's going to be important because when we invest in kids, we start by investing in the development of young kids, and when we do that, we increase school readiness and increase educational attainment. And when we do that, we increase workforce productivity and increase our competitiveness for Utah businesses. And when we do that, we enhance economic growth and prosperity. So investing in Utah kids is really an answer. And we have a lot of ways that we can do that. In terms of early education, we really need to start building necessary child care funding into our state budget. Even before the pandemic forced statewide shutdowns, the child care system in Utah was too small to serve the needs of Utah workers, according to a report released in early March by Utah's Office of Child Care. There's a 65% gap between workers' need for child care and the system's ability to provide it. So we need to start looking at how do we make sure that Utah workers have the capacity to meet child care needs. That's one of the things we can do. In terms of health care, again, Utah has one of the highest rates of uninsured children in the nation. Between 2016 and 2019, even before the pandemic, our rate of uninsured children increased from 6 to 8.3%. And we now rank 46th, I think, when it comes to uninsured kids. But solutions exist. We can invest in consistent outreach efforts to let people know about Medicare or Medicaid and CHIP, because many of the people who are eligible for insurance aren't aware that they're eligible. So outreach would be a huge issue. We can make sure that children who are enrolled in Medicaid are guaranteed year-round continuous eligibility, similar to what private health insurance does. And we can cover all Utah kids regardless of what their citizenship status is. So lots of things we can do. And I think Utah's well poised to do all of this stuff. Our economic situation is much better than many states in the nation. So there's lots of things I think we can do.
Yeah. And of course, children defined ages 0 to 18. I mean, are we seeing different issues present in different age groups?
Well, I mean, obviously, 18-year-olds don't need early child care, enhancements. But what we do know is that if we start early and we make sure that those kids who are, you know, needing extra care and extra help with quality child care, by the time they're 18, they're still doing well, right? They're still up with their peers. They're doing what they need to do. So I think what this really points to is making sure we invest in kids early, we keep investing in kids, and by the time they're 18, we make sure that we're doing it right. And then we, you know, they reach 16, 17, whatever age we're talking about there. We're committed to the belief that children should be nurtured, educated, and given an equitable chance to succeed. And that means allowing young people to make mistakes and learn from them and develop accountability to themselves and their community. So we have some recommendations in the report around juvenile justice, which we think would be great. We urge elected officials to support innovative school-based efforts to meet the unique needs of individual children within a safe and supportive school community. You know, I think children need a chance to learn and grow, and that includes the opportunity to make mistakes and learn from them without being pushed out of school and into the court system. So there's things we can do, I think, at every age level that would ensure that Utah's doing a good job by their children.
Yeah. Let's talk specifically about education. Here in the Wasatch Back, our school district leaders say it's essential that children stay in school. But what about the youngest children? Again, with the lack of child care and early childhood education, what about those kids who have had no socialization with others and certainly maybe limited stimulation because the parents are so busy at home working?
Right. And we know that this pandemic was going, we were doing a fairly decent job of trying to decrease that, that kind of gap between the have and the have nots in terms of, you know, educational attainment. So we've always looked at quality child care and making sure that, you know, how do we make sure that children have, if they need it and they want it, quality child care for their kids. And the same thing is true of all-day kindergarten programs. By 2019-2020, we had 7.5 million in the OEK program, which meant a dwindling full-day kindergarten funding effort. Costs go up, funding stays the same, and we rank kind of toward the bottom of the national in full-day kindergarten participation. In 2020, we added 5 million to our full-day kindergarten funding, and another 5 million because of the CARES Act. But that's one-time emergency funding and doesn't count towards, the things that we need to do to make sure that we're getting what we need. I think during the 2021 legislative session, we're going to need to replace that 5 million from the CARES Act funding with ongoing state funding that would increase the state's full-day kindergarten funding effort to the equivalent of about 10,380 kids, 21% of all Utah kindergartners. I mean, some families don't want full-day kindergarten, we don't need to make sure it's funding every child, but for some, half-day kindergarten is a good fit for their kid and their family. But if we assume only 85% of our kindergartners would be enrolled in that voluntary full-day kindergarten program, it would cost about $70 million to cover that extra 0.45 WPU for interested Utah families. So I think, you know, we can do that. We have the ability to do that. And schools are going to be important, I think, in the pandemic recovery in terms of mental health issues. One of the recommendations that the Casey Foundation had was to make sure we have enough counselors and school nurses, which we definitely do not. And so, you know, more funding, again, I know we seem to ask consistently for more funding for education, but the reality is we need money for counselors and for school nurses to help these kids who are coming back from the pandemic, possibly with mental health questions and problems that we need to address. So I'm confident that as a state we can do that. I'm confident as a state we can address the issues that, you know, were there before the pandemic but are also exacerbated by the pandemic. We have the economic means. We talk in our report on Invest in Utah Kids about, you know, what do we do in terms of, you know, our fiscal responsibility and how do we pay for it? And so, you know, we can make the good choices. And I think if we make the best choices, we can help foster that opportunity for all children and lay that foundation for Utah's future for growth and prosperity.
Okay. Hey, anything else you'd like to mention, Terry?
I would just encourage people to go on our website and read this report, both of them. There's the report on the pandemic and also the report that we just released yesterday at our press conference on Invest in Utah Kids. It's really an agenda, we think, for Utah's new governor and legislature, and we're hoping that the state of Utah gets behind it and lets their legislators know what they think needs to happen.
Okay. Terry Haven, again, the Deputy Director for Utah Voices for Utah Children. Appreciate your time this morning.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Do you like what you hear on KPCW? Help support public radio in your community by donating on our website. It's easy. Go to kpcw.org and click the donate button on the top right-hand side of the screen. Here at KPCW, we turn listeners into neighbors by keeping you informed on what's happening in your community. Show your KPCW love by donating on kpcw.org.